God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anybody here in your first 30 days of sobriety? If we could just have your first name, we'd just like to welcome you. We're not going to interview you. Anybody in their first 30 days?
Bianca Ford, 30 days today.
Bianca, welcome.
I just got a rehab today.
Awesome. So glad you joined us.
Thank you.
Welcome. I'm sure people will put their numbers in the chat for all you. Right. I believe that's, let me just check that. Is that available to everybody? Aha. I'm going to set it so everyone can chat publicly right now. So
okay.
That's awesome. Anybody else in their first 30 days? You're the reason we're here. All right. And Christine has volunteered to read the preamble.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Christine. I'm an alcoholic. This is the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks for letting me read.
Thank you very much. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Peter M. from Boca Raton, Florida. He's going to tell his story. And after Peter's done, we'll take a short break somewhere around the top of the hour, and we'll do the seventh tradition, maybe call for a couple of announcements, and then we'll be able to ask, we'll reconvene, and for the last half hour of the meeting, we'll be able to ask him whatever questions that you have. So the questions come entirely from the people attending the meeting. So please, you'll see the user questions. Please chat your questions as they occur to you, and then that'll become part of the meeting. Okay, make sense? Awesome. So Peter, so happy that you came to share with us tonight. I'm really looking forward to it. And I had a lovely conversation with him before we started the meeting, and I don't want to take up another minute of your time. Thank you again, Peter.
To be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dave, thanks so much for having me in the group, for having me. And to the young lady with 30 days who just got out of treatment, welcome home. And our big book says the best years of our life lay ahead of us. So welcome. And I hope that even though we're doing Zoom, you get a taste of the great things and the good news that we're able to talk about and experience in the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol. I'm very grateful to be a recovered member of this fellowship. And as a recovered member, I automatically assume a responsibility to uphold the traditions as well as the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I have no idea what's in the tank tonight. I'm praying God gives me a little endurance here. It has been a week of weeks. My better half, Marion, is just coming off of COVID. I have one of my staff members out with COVID and five of my clients down and out with COVID. And this week has been, as you could imagine, looked like a MASH unit at work at my facility. And thank the good Lord, other than one guy who has an asthma problem, we had to take him to the hospital. He's fine. No one's has symptoms, but we need to be real careful. So as the CEO, you can imagine the weight on my shoulders this week to keep everyone safe and protected. But I was sitting on the couch at Marion saying, I don't know how I'm going to do this hour, man. I think I'll just lie for an hour and get it over with because there is nothing in the tank. And, you know, what God did today, just give me a really fulfilling day. It started off with usual prayer, meditation, and doing some things around the house. And we usually go to Mass. I'm a Catholic at 6 o'clock on a Sunday, but I had this commitment and we went noon. And I got a call from my sponsor, and he has this two-way prayer thing he works with almost as long as he's sober, and it's getting published. And he wanted to share some of the pages with Marion and I, which to me was sacred. And it just turned out to be a fulfilling day, as exhausted as I am, how God just rewards you and gives you some inspiration, knowing I had a job to do tonight, and that was to speak. And one of the reasons why I share that, because I get excited talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I get excited talking about the good news. I get excited talking about this God, whether we practice our religion or not. But there was a time when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I had lots of contempt and anger and suspicion and doubt about the whole thing. My mom committed suicide when I was 14. My dad and I just never got along. And in 1988, I was living in an abandoned building, and I just wondered, well, if there is a God, he's awfully cruel. And I look, as our book said, these worldly clamors, and I says, he's probably, I never doubted the existence of this God, but I just figured he was punishing and not very loving like they try to convince me he was. And so I stayed away. And anytime I go to my religious community, I would take inventory and criticize the heck out of them and not go back again, all the while being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I like to consider in good standing, and telling you how much I love God, but I refuse to go to his house. And so I'm doing a fifth step with my sponsor, who, by the way, is Mickey Mustard out of Denver, Colorado. And you know, in the fourth step, when you write down about your resentments towards institutions, I had put down Catholic Church and a whole truckload of causes while I was angry with it. And I was very matter of fact in this reading. And by the time I got to the fourth column, my sponsor, Mickey, says, back up, which is a sponsor's way of saying, sponsor language for saying you're in trouble, you got caught. And he said to me, how long have you been nursing this resentment for? And I immediately pushed back on him, saying, well, and I gave all my justification for it. And he listened. And this is the importance of being open, teachable, hitting a wall, and having a good sponsor. And he asked me some questions, and it went like this. He says, do you go to AA? Which was kind of a ridiculous question. Of course I do. And he says, is every AA meeting a great meeting? I said, no. He says, are there 13 steppers in AA? I says, yeah. He says, do you know people who accepted one or two or three and so on coins who you knew were loaded while they were getting the coin? I says, yeah, I have. He's, but you keep going back. I says, yes. And you practice love, tolerance, forgiveness, acceptance, and bring a solution and pray for those people. I says, yes. And he says, how come you can't do that with your own church? And that silence you hear is what he heard. I got caught. He's, I'm not telling you to go back, you should. He's, but you need to fix this resentment. And so I wrote some more, and we talked some more, and I wrote some more and talked some more. And when I started to share some more with him, he says, you need to make amends. You need to go back there and sit with the priest and tell him all your slandering and gossiping and all of that. I mean, you've harmed an institution that did nothing to you. So one Saturday, I muster up enough courage after prayer to walk in something called a confession booth. And I sit with the priest there and I tell him I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is what I've been saying, and this is what I've been doing. And he said to me, after he gave me absolution and everything, so I understand, is what he said. I couldn't believe it. And he began to talk to me about my experiences, my staying away. And part of the ninth step is, what do I need to do to make it right? And he said to me, can you come to Mass tomorrow morning? I said, sure, I will. And I went to that Mass on Sunday morning to clean up the wreckage of my past. I was going to be a good AA member, make that amends, and never return again. I'm off the hook. I've been going ever since, because when I walked in, as I was walking up, I hear the bells going off and my chest is starting to vibrate. And I'm nervous, afraid, and excited all at the same time. And I'm sitting in there and I felt like I was home. And about two thirds of the way through, they say the Lord's Prayer like we do in AA, hold hands. This is pre-COVID, like we do in AA. And I began to weep and I realized the past was behind me and it was going to stay there. I got free, how dark it is before the dawn. And I was finally home and free, and I've been going ever since. And so I share that because of the freedom I experienced by having a good teacher and God giving me a mustard seed of willing to be teachable and change. And that I was not letting go absolutely. I was still holding on to my past contempt, my past anger, my past belief systems, which meant I had plaque on the soul. I wasn't letting go absolutely. God was not everything. God was the things I wanted him to be on my terms, and I wasn't free. And I do service there. I've done service there for a long time. It's been incredible. COVID has changed the routine there, but I used to be on the road a lot of weekends, but with all the conferences being closed, it's pretty much, well, not pretty much, every Sunday I'm in there, and my soul gets full, and I have the best of both worlds. I have Alcoholics Anonymous first, and I have this along with, not instead of, and I get soul food. And what has happened for me, my prayer life, my life of meditation, my point of view on life, on most days that life is not coming at me, but I get to pack into the stream of life. And on most days, I'm looking at things as they are, not as I see them. And that all came out of just doing 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And my relationship with this God, listen, it's not perfect. I don't do anything perfect. Let me tell you that on the front end. But my relationship with this God has changed so much. When a book talks about feeling the nearness of our Creator, I mean, it's an understatement because it's limitless how far we can go with God, the abundance we can experience by doing simple steps 4 through 9. So I'm very grateful for where God has brought me to 32 plus years later and still in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is my life. I grew up in an area in New York called Brooklyn, New York, and that's where I took my first drink. And it was an area called Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, that my first home group I went to. And if anyone doesn't know Bensonhurst, if you remember the John Travolta movie with Saturday Night Fever, that's where I grew up. In fact, my first home group, we thought The Godfather was an educational movie. It was that kind of crowd in there. And at 14 years old, back in the 60s, we had our problems. Some of you guys remember some of the things that were going on in the 60s, pales in comparison to what we have going on now. But there was something cool about the 60s. It was before MTV and disco ruined everything. So it was a really cool time. And we used to hang out on street corners. The guys would listen. We used to listen to rock and Motown. That was the thing. And drink beer. And the older, I was one of the younger guys, I was 14, and the older guys were like 16 and 17. And then you had the really old crowd, the little gangster crowd, they were in their 20s, and they all hung out and drank beer, listened to music on the corner, roughhouse, flirted with the girls. And during the summertime, the corners were packed. And it was just a cool way to grow up. And but I was not okay. Yeah, I was not okay at that age. I was a very gifted musician growing up. My family wanted to send me to Juilliard. Very gifted. I'd start off, I was a drummer, became a percussionist, was playing piano, was playing saxophone. I was just give me an instrument and I can play it. It was just one of those things. And I loved it. I also wanted to be a hippie because I loved the hippies in the 60s. I remember being 10 years old, crying on my couch because my mom and dad didn't want to take me to Woodstock. And I wanted to go to Woodstock at 10 years old. I wanted to play drums for the Rolling Stones. And Eric Clapton was my hero. And just, you know, I wanted to be Keith Richards. And that was usually, that was a bad sign for what I was about to turn into, you know. But it was a cool time. I was not okay. in January 74, my mom committed suicide. She was alcoholic and had some psych issues and addicted to every tranquilizer you could think of. And we took many trips to psych wards and like that, and many attempts at suicide. And in 1974, January, she finally did it. And I remember waking up that morning, hearing my dad whimpering on the phone. "Please come, I think my wife is dead." And I was so afraid. I was laying in my bunk bed, in the lower bunk. I have two brothers, and one was up above me. The other one was in the other bunk, and they jumped out of bed, and I was literally frozen in fear. I couldn't move. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And it was one of the worst days of my life. And my mom brought me up on God loves you, and all things are possible with God. You pray to God, he'll treat you well, and all these things. And I watched this woman get sicker and sick and commit suicide. What happened to God? And it wasn't a conscious decision, but somewhere in me, I knew God was for children and women. I need to be a man now. And my dad was the street tough guy, the alpha male, and he and I never got along. It was really difficult. We just saw the world different, and it wasn't very pretty. So at 14, when I show up to a corner and I'm watching these guys drink, I want what they got, what they're experiencing, but I was just afraid to do it. And one Saturday night, I grabbed a quart of beer, Colt 45 beer. And I don't know till this moment why, but I began to drink, and I never got drunk before. I never drank any kind of alcohol other than as a kid in an Italian family, they give you a little bit of wine once in a while, swearing it's good for you, but I never drank. And this night I drank. Because I wasn't drinking for taste. I wanted to drink to get what those guys had. Yeah? And I didn't ask where the Colt 45 beer was brewed. I didn't ask who brewed it. I didn't ask about the cleanliness of the bodega that they bought the beer out of. I just drank it because I saw what was doing to them. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're talking about the steps and God, and I got to do a due diligence report and wait 90 days before I decide to do this. So when you look in the dictionary and the hypocrite, my 8x10 photo's there. So I began to drink Colt 45 beer, and about halfway through, I experienced something I never did before. I can breathe. I felt at ease. Bill says I had arrived. I showed up for life on that street corner. It was euphoric. It was incredible. The girls got prettier. I had beer muscles. I became Al Capone by around midnight. It was a wonderful experience. There, no one beat me up. I did not get locked up. The music got better. You know, listening to like Diana Ross, all of a sudden I felt like I was in concert with her as I was getting drunk. I was there. This is the coolest thing. And the night ended and I headed home, and it was probably around midnight, and I suddenly didn't want to go home. I tasted the honey. I tasted some freedom. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, that until I get free, I won't realize how much bondage I'm in. And when I realized that I have to go to school sober, I have to do all these other things sober after feeling drunk like I am right now, I don't want to go back to that. I want this drunk to last for eternity. I don't want to do life sober anymore. I tasted the honey. I can't go back anymore. The problem with me was I wanted to continue to drink, and I really needed to continue to drink, and because I immediately, right from the drunk, the first drunk, I wanted more. That was called craving, which I learned about in Alcoholics Anonymous. My cravings intensified. It's not satisfied when I drink. There were so many times, you know, you go to the first drink because the mind demands you take a drink. I take the first drink, and for some reason, the second drink screams louder, and the third drink is demanded, and I can't get out. There were so many times right before I got sober, I knew the people in my family despised me for what I turned into. I burned every bridge. I had been arrested a bunch of times. I've been through 7 treatment centers. I was living in an abandoned building in 1988, and I knew they despised what I turned into. I stole from everyone, caused scenes. I was ugly, sloppy, you know the drill. And moreover, I despised myself for being such a weakling that I couldn't get on with my life. And I would look at the whiskey bottle and curse it for wrecking my life, only to finish it off or on my way to a liquor store, knowing what I'm about to do. This is going to end bad, but I had to go. Getting out of a treatment center stone cold sober and picking up a drink. I never picked up the first drink drunk. I always picked up the first drink sober. Get out of treatment after 28 days, get released ROR from the judge or however long I was in there, get detoxed, hit the fresh air, first move, get a pint when my body was sober, because my alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle of whiskey. My alcoholism sits right up here in the head. I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. I'm sober over 32 years. I'm not cured. I'm recovered, but not cured. I'm recovered today. I don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. I start to back away from God. You'll be taking me to a detox because I have alcoholism and there's old default button. That default button says double vodka now. That's what I got. Wants me dead, will settle for me drunk. And I'm the type of alcoholic. And I know you guys can identify with this. I'm preaching to the choir here. But I will pay any price tomorrow to get comfort today. I know she's going to throw me out. I know I'm going to get arrested. I know I'm going to lose my job. And the list goes on and on and on. But right now I need to do this. I have to do this. I can't get out. And the mind always wins. The greatest predator to hit the planet since the beginning of time is a four-letter word called the mind. I'm a slave to it rather than it serving me. And the only thing the mind cannot combat is God. And I'm going through life where I don't need God. So guess who's in charge? This predator called the mind. It convinces me to do the worst things in the world. It convinces me I'm a loser. I'm insecure. It convinces me I'm better than you. It's never, ever telling me the truth. So why do we tell newcomers, bring the body and the mind will follow? The last thing I want is any newcomer's mind in my country, period. Especially in my home group. Just get to the meeting. Let us work on your soul. It'll change the mind. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is really about. It's a soulful journey, and I get soul food in AA. And once the soul is awakened, I'm led by the soul rather than being dragged around by my own thinking. That never worked. So at 14, I take my first drunk. It's incredible. And the following weekend, I get back to the street corner and I'm not waiting. I need to get right in there, make nice to the older guys so they give me something to drink. And they were beer drinkers back then. And I drank immediately for effect, and I always wanted more. And my drinking, as Bill says in his story, assumed more serious proportions. And like a crescendo in music, it gets louder, it gets bigger. That's what was happening to my alcoholism, and it was becoming infectious. It was hurting people. My two younger brothers idolized me. I was the kid, the neighborhood musician who was going to make it big, and they really looked up to me. I was good in school. I was a good little athlete, and I had a lot of nice things going for me. And then my brothers became embarrassed by me. I would make a scene drunk. And my dad thought a lunacy commission should be appointed for me. You know, then your grandparents sit you down and have the father and son talk, but it's through the grandparents that I'm wrecking my life. And then the uncles and the distant, everyone, I'm taking everyone hostage, and everyone has a remedy on how to straighten my life out. And as an alcoholic, it was like, leave me alone. It's my life. You don't carry a heavy cross like I do. I thought I was the only one with life problems. And even if I did, I had no solution to any of them other than drink them away. And the more I drank and the more numb I became, the life problems went away. I poured alcohol on this thing called alcoholism. If I didn't have that, it would have probably blew my brains out by the time I was 21, because life hurt. And what I have to share with you is, left untreated in AA, my first 6 months in AA was awful. I was completely untreated and I was Looney Tunes, waiting for the miracle to happen, failing to realize God got me sober. The miracle has happened. And there's been times in Alcoholics Anonymous where I'd been in the valley and I couldn't get out of my own way, or fear had me. But the difference between then and my years in AA, I had a solution to go to. So those valleys weren't that deep and they were far apart. And what I have found out in AA, that working, quote unquote, working a program, it doesn't mean I transcend my alcoholism. It just means I'm able to do life on God's terms. And when I fall in a ditch or I fall out of the saddle, there's a program for me to get back out of there and back in the saddle and keep moving and chop wood and carry water, as I like to say. Because life happens, it's problematic, it's unfair. We live in a world of impermanence. I don't think anyone in their right mind said, I hope they come down with COVID so all of us can go into quarantine. It showed up and here we are. How do I navigate through that? You know, some of us have gone through incredibly painful hardship with this thing. How do I navigate through that? Life is unfair. I better have a God and I better be able to let go, absolutely. So I started to steal. Because I'm an alcoholic and God forbid I should get a job, I start to steal. And I stole from my dad, stole from my family, but I discovered my dad's checkbook one day in this closet, and I forged his name on the check. I went down to the local store and they knew who he was. And they didn't want him coming in case he really wrote out the check. If anyone's ever seen the movie Goodfellas, that Robert De Niro character, that's my dad. And so they didn't want him walking in. So they cashed the check for me with reluctance, but they didn't. I walked out with beer. Now, I didn't know anything about something called a checking statement back then. I'm about as sharp as a bowling ball, to give you an idea. And so when I got away with it, I just figured I hit Powerball, man. I got a sure bet here. And I started taking these checks and going to this store and to that store and to this store and that store. And then he got a checking statement back and it was a bad day. He came looking for me. This is the type of guy, even when he's happy, he doesn't smile. So he was looking for me and I was in some serious trouble. And I was sitting in a car in Lower Manhattan with this young lady that I had met the night before, drunk. So naturally, I'm in love. And usually I go from love to stalking within a week. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. That's how I have relationships. And he drove up and he jumped out of the car and I ran away. And when he caught me, I blamed the girl in the car. I blamed a lot of things, mom dying. And he took me to my first treatment center. Now, he didn't know what a treatment center was. He was told by some friends, your son needs to go here if he's drinking too much. I didn't know what a treatment center was. Even though my mom was alcoholic, I still imagine an alcoholic as a Bowery bum, which was about to happen to me, fast forward a few years. And I walked into this place and I was petrified. It's the same psych hospital that we had taken to my mom about 20 times, and they had a little treatment center in there. And I got in there and began to cry. Like I got dropped off at day camp and mommy and daddy weren't coming home, missed the big shot. And 28 days later, I get discharged and I'm drunk an hour later. Well, why not? I'm not an alcoholic. I just don't want to deal with my old man. So I go to this place. And the trapdoors have trapdoors. And as Bill says, my drinking assumes more serious proportions. Now, I'm walking around in my mind, right? The mind is a wonderful servant, as they say, a terrible master. And it owned me. And it has all these ideas about what I'm supposed to be doing with my life, yeah? What I'm supposed to turn into, how much money I'm supposed to have. All these roles that I want to play, most of them is what I think you want me to be. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I get introduced to the importance of prayer, not knowing where prayer is going to take me and the depth of prayer, that it brings death to every identity that does not come from God. There's freedom. to experience going, I know everything, to finding out that God is way beyond my cleverest plans. That's freedom. To understand how broken and flawed I am in my humanness, that I do not need to be perfect, especially in a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous, that is freedom. And I get to travel light. What I've learned in my experience in AA thus far is that we talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The what it was like is sharing our brokenness with each other. It's a shared brokenness. The common problem. And a lot of us can agree on the common solution, not all. But we identify, we get it. But back then, I didn't know that. I thought I was the only one who had my problems. And so I made my second treatment center because I was getting worse. And I made my third treatment center because it was getting even worse. And around there, I got addicted to some non-conference approved dry goods. And they took me to depths of despair and doing things that I couldn't even fathom the first time I got drunk that I would be doing. Lying became an everyday activity along with stealing. Knowing what I'm stealing is going to hurt someone, you know, a piece of jewelry, a prized possession, whatever it was, a watch for God's sake, but it was important to that person. See, my alcoholism doesn't give me a seed of compassion or empathy for anyone because it's consumed with me. The self is the self, and it's just consumed with itself. And so that's what I would do. And I remember going into my fifth treatment center. And by now, everyone knows what I am. I know what I am. And I even had a powerful desire to stop drinking and doing those other things. But we live life forward and understand it backwards. I had a powerful desire to stop, but I wasn't willing to go to any lengths to stay stopped. There were conditions on what this was going to look like. I'll just curtail a little bit. I'll mix it up a little bit. I definitely won't go back to the powder stuff because that's just agony. I'll just drink safely and moderately because, after all, I'm a heavy social drinker with alcoholic overtones. I'm not a real alcoholic. And when I went into my fifth treatment center, I always talk about, for me, I had to meet my demons, if you will, face to face, which was about to happen to me. Because when I went into the fifth treatment center, they told me you really shouldn't go home after the 28-day spin dry, which is the model back then. You need to stick around a while. And I really had no choice because there was nowhere for me to go at this point. So I stay in this inpatient lockdown treatment facility in Amityville, Long Island for 9 weeks. And I started eating regularly and showering regularly and going to the groups, and they would take me to the little fitness center. And after 9 weeks, you know what? You look healthy. You put on some weight, get some color back in your face. You got a normal complexion. I'm shaving and showering, and I'm eating and going to group, and I'm working out. And with 9 weeks, they said, listen, we need to discharge you. We can't hold you anymore. And it was a Saturday morning when they discharged me. And I gave the typical alcoholic, naive reply. And that was, I know what I need to do. And I hit the fresh air, and I was slapped right in the face with life. You know those voices that we walk around with, the committee up in the head? You know, like you wake up at 5 a.m. and 2 minutes after 5, you're in a heated argument with someone who died 20 years ago. I know what the day's going to look like. I know what the day's going to look like. So I lock and load, and I pray. I'm Moses, and I'm ready to go, and I turn into Rambo because all of these voices are telling me how it's going. That's what I was like. And when I hit the fresh air, there was a lot of stuff going on in my head, including the alcohol call, and that was, we need a drink right now, because this is way too fast. Just take the edge off, settle the belly down, stop the anxiety. Pete, just one drink. I swear to you, one drink and we'll go to AA, but you need something now. And I went back to my dad's house where I stayed Saturday and Sunday. And here's how my alcoholism showed up. My body did not need any kind of mood or mind-altering substance. My body definitely didn't need alcohol. 9 weeks, I'm detoxed. I had nothing called post-acute withdrawal syndrome. My body was as sober as it was going to be forever. But the obsession in my head was so loud and so strong, I began to feel physically ill, like I needed a drink. And by Monday morning, I'm crawling out of my skin. And I went to a liquor store. He wasn't open when I arrived, and I'm pacing up and down on the sidewalk. My plan was to get a pint of whiskey, get in the car, and go home and drink and drive, and it's going to be a beautiful day on Monday. And when I finally bought a pint of whiskey, I drank it down as fast as I could because I felt like I was going through withdrawal, and I wasn't. My alcoholism doesn't come on a bottle of whiskey. The main problem centers up here. It convinced me I need a drink. And I drank a pint of whiskey down as fast as I could. And you know what happened? My stomach settled down. The vibrating in my chest stopped. The forehead stopped sweating. My hands stopped shaking. I felt in control and powerful. I'm ready to do life. Except I never made it to the car because I'm an alcoholic. I had to go back in and get another pint of whiskey. I didn't even leave. And I bought another pint of whiskey. I went on one of the worst drunks ever. I got locked up a couple of times on this drunk. I got thrown out of my house for good. I was eating. I would get drunk and buy pills and eat as many pills as I can. And that's all I would do. And I'd go from whoever would take me in for a day or two. And I landed in my sixth treatment center, truly by a God story. And I spent 36 hours in the same treatment center and walked out the door after 36 hours. I was convinced I will never stay sober. I wasn't even worthy of sobriety in my mind. And I knew my mind told me. So therefore, when my mind talks to me, that my thoughts, I believe them to be true. That's why they're so powerful. That Alcoholics Anonymous was for educated people, well-to-do people, rich people, not a bum like you from Brooklyn. And I know you were telling me a day at a time, but I know you meant forever, and I couldn't even fathom that. And I can't do this detox anymore. They're just too painful. So out the door I went, and I just wanted to die, and I tried. I was in some flea bag motel and ate, I don't know, however many Valium were in this pill bottle, and swallowed them down with Jack Daniels. And I got back into bed and welcomed the idea of dying because I couldn't do it. It hurt too much. It's been one big mistake. And the aha moment, I've been inflicting pain on everyone. My existence is not needed anymore. This is what my mind does to me. Why on God's earth, with in sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous, do I want to use my mind for anything? Because at the end of the thinking, there's always a drink attached to my thinking. All the time I'm an alcoholic. And so my first day really homeless on the streets, I'm not the toughest guy in the bar. I don't know how to do the streets. And I realize I have nowhere to lay my head tonight. I'm hungry, I have no money, and I definitely need a drink, and I don't know what to do for money. So you start to panhandle, and you learn. And I find this abandoned building, and it creeped me out the first night. I got used to it, and I was somewhat comfortable residing in the back of an abandoned building in an era of Manhattan called Alphabet City back in the day. And my life consisted of panhandling, stealing, liquor store, pass out, over and over and over again. I lost contact with my family, and I got to a point where in our big book, and I studied our big book for years, and then one day, you know, they put something in the big book without your permission that's new, and you say, when did that get in there? And on page 43, it says this: 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Some doctor referred to us as this type of people, that we're 100% hopeless apart from divine help. And it caught me. Live life forward, understand it backwards. And I reflected to back then that that's where I was right before God surrendered me in June of 88. that I was 100% hopeless apart from his help, divine help. And what that meant for me looking back on it was I had a body that refused to die, a mind that stopped working, that I couldn't get drunk anymore. I can't get sober. I can't even die. And I'm going to be stuck in this building just getting enough alcohol in me to stop the shaking. And that is it. That's my existence. And that scared me to death. It was this aha moment where, if you will, God split me open figuratively so his light can get in. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had that. When that day, the desperation screamed louder than the ego. I have not had that since I've been in AA. But I've been in a place after a divorce and the ex-wife took everything, I was left with nothing and some financial challenges and maybe some health scares along the way, where I'm feeling most vulnerable, most weak, most transparent is where I find God's brightest light and greatest strength. And the strength that God gives us is not worldly strength, like going to a gym and bench pressing 300 pounds, but it's a strength that's even greater than that because it's God, that allows us to walk through a desert and those uncertain times. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. Guys, I'd never been to, well, I spent about 15 minutes in college and decided to get drunk and never returned. So I'm not like this educated guy. I'm not that insightful. I'm not that great. God is that great that he doesn't pick and choose who's going to get this wonderful gift because he just gives it away to all his kids, regardless of race, color, creed. If I got antennas coming out of my head, he really don't care. He made it in the first place. And I remember getting up off the floor in the back of this abandoned building, and I collapsed. I began to weep uncontrollably, and I thought I was completely losing my mind. Where are all these tears coming from? And again, I look back on it now. It was years, years. The last time I had cried was when I buried my mom. Since then, I had walled up. Nothing was getting in or out. And it was just this purging of betrayals, embarrassment, shame, guilt, remorse, and alcoholism. And I couldn't stop weeping. And I remember praying to this God who I despise, please take me from this. I don't want to die. I wasn't thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous or going to treatment again. I knew AA was a cult and it didn't work and it's for special people. I knew treatment didn't work. I knew my religion didn't work. So I wasn't thinking about that. God was great enough not to feed me that. What he fed me was the gift of desperation, a G-O-D, where I said, I don't want to die. I just don't want to die. I don't care where I land. I just don't want to die. Please take me from this. I don't want to die. And my dad was in Atlantic City, New Jersey on this particular day. And by the way, I didn't even know it was June when I got into treatment. They told me, it's June 23rd. This is your sober day. And I wanted to like throw a chair through a window because they were so happy and I was so miserable. My dad, that particular day, was in Atlantic City, New Jersey, spending some time with his wife. And as he tells the story, he was jarred out of his sleep around 2:30 in the morning, and the instructions he's got, he didn't call it God back then, he does now, was to go find me. And God connected the dots because he got dressed, he left his wife there, got in his car, and drove from Atlantic City, New Jersey to Lower Manhattan. It's a bit of a drive. And he wasn't driving along Park Avenue looking like at the expensive part of Manhattan or Rockefeller Center. He was in the hood looking for me. I mean, what an order. He can't go through with it, but God gave him enough to go do it. And he finds me Looney Tunes standing on a street corner, and I got these bloodstained soil pants. I got construction boots. The right boot had no front. I'm filthy. I'm going through withdrawal constantly, so I'm sweating profusely, and I'm cold at the same time. It's June. I have a turtleneck and a zip-up jacket. I'm cold and sweating. And my dad shows up to the corner, got out of the car, and when he walked across the street, I collapsed. And he held on to me and he kept repeating, I'm not going to lose my son to this, over and over and over. When I look back on it now, God allowed our roots to grasp new soil. God is always beyond our cleverest plans, drunk or sober. And what I learned from that, I didn't know it back then, I do now, that when a book says we're alcoholics and cannot manage our own life, that's drunk or sober. For me, is I have no business managing my life, drunk or sober, because I make a mess of everything. I'm the type of alcoholic will cause a traffic jam and I'm the only guy on the highway. But the ego, as Tebow talked about, Harry Tebow talks about, likes to flex its muscles and rebuilds and says, we're in charge. Look at you. You're doing great. You really don't need to call your sponsor on this one, and you don't need to pray. And what I start to do is take a step towards my alcoholism. I go down to the beach here. I live close to the water in Florida, and it's a pretty cool thing. That's a little shameless plug for South Florida, by the way. But sometimes you go out into the water, Mary and I go out there, and we park our beach chairs in a certain spot, and we walk straight ahead out into the water. And sometimes there's a little undercurrent, nothing to worry about. You can just feel a little push, no big deal. And you kind of swim around, play around, have some fun. And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, however long I'm in there, I say, Maren, let's go back and get on the beach chairs. And we turn around and we can't find our beach chairs because they're way over there and we've drifted way over there without even realizing it. And so when I start to run my life, little by slowly, I start to drift away, and alcoholism is truly Satan's work, that it won't even reveal itself. I'm drifting away from God, drifting away from God, drifting away from God. And then one day life hits and I have no more home base. I lost contact with all of you and I get drunk, and it happens little by slowly. For me, this whole thing hinges on my relationship with God. And so the steps take me there. I have found, and this is for me, my sponsor alone won't keep me sober. My meetings alone won't keep me sober. My big book alone won't keep me sober. All those things alone won't keep me sober. But every one of them is vital, because put together, they take me to the power that's keeping me sober all along. If I wanted to bake a cake, I need milk and sugar and flour. I can't make a cake with just milk. I need milk, but I need the other things. Put it all together, I have a cake. And for me, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. All of it's vital. But they all got to work in concert, so I can experience a relationship with this God of my own understanding, not anyone else's. And I got into the 7 treatment center, and after about 10 days of being in my 7 treatment center, I got thirsty. And this was too much for me. It was overwhelming. I don't know how I'm going to do this. My body hurt. I had hepatitis C. I was urinating blood. I weighed about 130 pounds. That's about 60 something pounds less than I weigh right now. And I was in some serious trouble physically, let alone emotionally. And nothing spiritually was going on at all. I had no muscle spiritually. And what they did was they said, you need to get out of New York. And they shipped me out to Minnesota. And I wound up, doing more treatment, halfway house, a sober house. And somewhere in there, some folks took me to a meeting called the Three Legacies meeting in Minneapolis. This was a Friday night meeting, about 300 people. Everyone was dressed proper. And the speakers suited up, women suited up. They brought respect and honor and dignity to the podium. There were no cell phones, so when you walked into a meeting, everyone was looking at the door for the new guy. They weren't glued to their phone taking selfies like we see nowadays in AA. Looking at Facebook while the guy one day is walking in and we miss him. They were looking at the door. Stan Shoemaker said, stand by the door. And I was new, and I was so embarrassed of how I was wearing my brother's clothes at this point. I had no clothes. But I still walked in, trying to pretend like I got it going on and I've been around a while. And as soon as I walked in the door, the old timer said, you're new, come with us. And my cover was blown as soon as I walked in the door. And God bless the old timers, because not all of them were in the book, but they were in AA. And those were the guys, the old timers. And to me, the old timers were 25, 30, 40 years. Some of them were real old timers. And they took me around. They always called us kid. You want a cup of coffee, kid. I lived in a town called Hastings, Minnesota, and this meeting was in Minneapolis. It was about an hour or so drive on a Friday night. And they start taking turns. Three or four in a car would pick me up, take me to the meeting, have a meeting in the car before the meeting. Then they go to eat. And they says, we're going to go out to eat before we take you home. I was mortified. I said, how am I going to get out of this? I have no money. They're going to a diner to eat. What do I do? I'm dying. And I never forget, one of the guys said something that reminded me of an expression I heard growing up in New York. And he says, you're with us now. You're with us now. Don't worry about money. And they ordered for me. They gave me a little thing to go home with. And we had a meeting in the car on the way home. And next week, another crew of guys. And they were holding on to their sobriety by giving it all away. I happened to be the new guy on campus. And that's why I always like, as long as God gives me the inspiration to mention a Three Legacies meeting, because those men and women in that group helped save my life. And after about a year, I was brought home to my first home group. And I've learned that God, as my sponsor's wife said, will use everything and everyone. That God's constantly pursuing me, all of us, to get our attention. That God doesn't love me if I change. God continues to love me, has always loved me, so that I change. That it's an ongoing process. That sometimes my greatest defects or my sinfulness in the past can be my greatest asset in working with another drunk. There's a great story, because I came in with so much guilt and remorse. There's a great story of a man who goes to his best friend and tells him, I want to change my life. I want to fix all the damage I've done. Can you tell me all the terrible things I've done? And his friend reminds him of every single thing he's done. That same guy goes before his creator and says, God, I want to change my life. I've done some terrible things in my life. Can you tell me all the things I've done that are bad? And God says, I don't remember. That's the God we go to. He doesn't hold a grudge, but forgives and loves. And I was introduced to that God in the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That family that was ripped apart by alcoholism, little by slowly, thank you, Al-Anon therapy and church and what AA has given me, has been put back together. Now, when you walk into a family reunion, you don't see butterflies and rainbows all over the room and harp music in the background. I mean, we're an Italian-American family. It's loud. It's like the Sopranos casting all over again. But we get along and we lean on each other and we support each other. I'll just share a quick story and I'll get out of here. When I was in Minnesota, I'm new. So, I have maybe a few months at this point. They're taking me to the Three Legacies meeting. And one night in a diner, one of the guys in a diner gave me one of those little AA coins, with Bill and Bob on the cover or something like that. First things first or a day at a time. One of those little AA trinkets. And he says, this is for you. And I don't like he was giving me the Academy Award for being a good AA man. I was so taken by that. And when I got back to my room and before I got into my bed, I had a little nightstand and I put the coin on the nightstand. And I thought that was just so nice. And I made my prayer and I got back into bed. And as I'm staring at the ceiling, out of nowhere, that old voice came back. Who are you kidding? You're Peter Marinelli from Brooklyn. These people are Minnesota people. They walk different. They talk different from you. They can stay sober. And it got worse and worse. And I started to think about drinking. Then I'm thinking I should go drink. And I began to cry. And I remember praying, Father, if you're out there, please, please don't let me walk out of this door tonight, because I know I'm not coming back. And what I did was, and I've told the story a few times, it sounds kind of silly, but I got the coin off the nightstand and I tucked it under my pillow, because I would hope that the AA angels, if they were out there, would keep me safe and protected. And I fell asleep and I woke up the next morning in that bed sober. And it was one of those little stories we all have, those little things that gets you through another week or another day, and it connects another dot. And I've been coming back ever since. See, the only thing God wants is my soul, and I give him my soul, and he gives me a life. I give him my life, and he has given me purpose. I've given him my sinfulness, and he gives me forgiveness. I've given my drunkenness, and he gave me sobriety. And every day I give him my sobriety, and he continues to feed me the sacred rooms called Alcoholics Anonymous. And for this, I owe AA and God everything. I can never pay it back. Marion always says you can't outgive God, but I chop wood and carry wood and do the best I can. Thank you for closing up my Sunday night and making it just a great day, as exhausted as I am, for being there for me, because I spoke, but you have fed me tonight. So thank you so much. That's all I got. Peace.
Peter, thank you so much. That was amazing. You guys have the ability to unmute momentarily and thank Peter before I take the meeting back.
Thank you so much, Peter. That was wonderful. Thank you.
Out of the ballpark. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
God bless you
very much. That was great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. I'm going to take the meeting back and give Peter a chance to exhale, and we'll do a little bit of business here before we resume. Everybody, please, if you have questions, please send them to the user questions. It's really Larry. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I placed a link in the chat to the Simple Actions PayPal account. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential. At every level of AA service, it is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I would be happy to take a few announcements by show of hands. Seeing none, I'll come back to that if somebody raises their hand. The Simple Actions group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Thank you, my favorite people right there. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you to not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. If you're shy, feel free to send an email message to info@simpleactions.net. All right, we're getting some questions rolling in. Please keep them coming. Send your questions to the user questions. Peter, thank you so much. That was amazing. I'm glad you found some energy. That was awesome. So our first question, how do you avoid drifting into worry, remorse, and morbid reflection? There you go.
My back. I like to say never drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, but that would be a lie because I have. What allows me to not go in there all the time is a few things. Having a prayer life and a God that I need to trust and depend upon. Having a sponsor and writing inventory. Nightly review. Making amends quickly. If I can go to God and ask him to allow my day to be a walking prayer and not just prayer and leave God behind at the altar, and live as if there's no God, but live as if there is a God and be a walking prayer, that worry, remorse, and morbid reflection starts to diminish. Besides, when I'm in a place of worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, what I'm simply doing is egos come in through the back door and consume with me, and I'm playing God once again. How could I possibly fall short? How could I have possibly said that? Oh my God, I'm better than that. That's playing God. I'm broken and flawed. I'm going to land in there once in a while.
Thank you. I love this question. What suggestions do you have for someone at their first meeting?
Go to another meeting. Let's start with that. Yeah, what I would suggest you do is let folks know you're new. It's really important so you don't fall through the cracks. Even if you have to stand on a table and say, I just got out of treatment, or I'm back, I have one day back, let us know who you are. It's not to embarrass you. We need to know who you are, because some folks may not realize you're just walking in for the first time. And I promise you, and I will say the ladies do this a lot better than us guys, they will circle the wagons for you and take you along, and you'll get some phone numbers and you dial them, don't file them, and get with a group, but get to another meeting. And if you're not working, you can get to, well, with Zoom, you can be on meetings all day long. But when we meet live, you know, we used to run in packs, make the morning meeting, make the noon meeting, make the 3 o'clock meeting, make the night meeting. And that's all we did. We had about $10 between 20 of us, but it was okay. And that's what we did.
$10 between 20 of us. That's awesome. How have the three legacies played a role in your sobriety?
Well, it's vital. How could you? It's like trying to live on a two-legged stool. So it's really important to be a member of good standing. And if I'm in the middle of AA, it means I'm part of the fellowship and the unity of the fellowship that I've gotten recovered through the big book, the recovery, the bottom portion of our triangle. And I'm giving it all away in service. A basic comes of ACE is the basic service we provide, I'm paraphrasing, is one drunk work with another. If I'm not living in all three sides of the triangle, I'm starting to get anemic in recovery. And I'm top heavy in meetings and I have nothing going on with the soul, which means I have no step work. And I kind of have a sponsor and I'm not really doing a good job at sponsoring. There is a drink waiting for me if I'm a real alcoholic. The cool thing about living in all three sides of the triangle is that circle around the triangle, when I came in, it was broken and shattered. And little by slowly, it starts to heal and become whole. No beginning, no end. It just is. So it's really, really important that living in all three sides of the triangle. Here's what goes on. I come into the fellowship and I get the program and then I give it all away in service. And it's like these three separate entities. But as we start to enter the world of the spirit, wake up spiritually, they all bleed into each other. It's all part of the same. And I become whole. I have had the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. Why wouldn't I want to live in all three sides?
Right on. Thank you. The next question is, what exactly is untreated alcoholism? Is it something you can suffer from years into recovery, even after doing the steps? And how do you get out of it?
Absolutely, you can suffer from it after doing the steps. Page 52, there's something called, about two-thirds of the way down, maybe halfway down, something called bedevilments. And bedevilments are something that torment, frustrate, and harass me. And there's about seven sentences. And we take those sentences, turn them into questions, trouble in personal relations, can't control my emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, and so on. It's called untreated alcoholism, which means I'm living in fear and resentment. I'm living in self-reliance and I'm not okay. I'm tight. I'm angry. I'm short-tempered. Everything bothers me. Now there's a story. I remember speaking, there was a gentleman passed. He's passed on, Paul Martin out of Chicago. And Paul Martin he was brought in by Dr. Bob and sponsored by a guy named Tom something. And Paul Martin would be my great grand sponsor. And I called him one day by the advice of Gary B. And he said, call Paul about this question. We got to talking. And what Paul said was, when the new folks came in, after about first generation, after about 5 years, they started to change. Fear showed up, resentment showed up, restless, irritable, and discontentment showed up, and they were experiencing untreated alcoholism, and he said he was one of them. And he was about to hear a fifth step from one of his sponsees, and he prayed and he had this idea that he should write some inventory and share it with the sponsee and see where it takes him. And it took him to a place of freedom. And he realized that he needed to do the steps again and again and again and again. But yes, we can go through the steps forward and not do anything else and begin to go backwards through the steps, figuratively speaking, and start to act and think and speak like an alcoholic who's no longer sober, even though we're sober. And alcoholism goes underground and resurfaces in other areas. They're called sex sprees, food sprees, fear sprees, money sprees, gambling sprees. My first 6 months or so in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was binging and purging. And I didn't want to tell anyone because I was so naive. I thought an eating disorder was a gender issue, and I'm a man. I only thought women had eating disorders. And it was this deep, dark secret. And someone got wind of it and confronted me and called my sponsor. And we went through the steps and he took me to OA. And thank you, God, it may have been the first nip of the ringer, but this is what I was doing untreated. I can't tell you how many folks I know, men I've met, doing workshops when I travel, and they're sober double digits, and they come up to me, says, you got a minute? I need to talk to you. I know where they're going. They're on a sex spree. Can't get away from pornography, chasing women, and it's killing them, and they know it. But they don't know what else to do with this monster screaming at them all day long. So yeah, it's really important that I grow in understanding and effectiveness. And for me, this is for me, annually go through the steps.
All right. What does it mean to be recovered instead of recovering?
Yeah. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which means God has removed the obsession, which means the craving or the compulsion is gone. And I get to live in the sunlight of the spirit. It doesn't mean cured. Recovering. Now, if you're recovering, I'm not here to split a room up, guys. I'm not here to say you got it wrong. I'm just sharing. I'm just a spoke in a wheel. Not a model, nor am I an example. But recovered doesn't mean cured. It just means we get to a place, it's the first promise in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Recovering is still, for me, being sober, but experiencing the symptoms, the untreated stuff, and the cycles of that. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I'm Moses. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I'm cheating on my wife. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I'm gripped in fear and resentment and anger and jealousy and suspicious and doubt and the seven deadly sins. And Tuesday later, I'm doing okay again. And then I'm having drink thoughts and drink singles, then I'm okay again. And I have an undercurrent of disease and discomfort most of the time. But I haven't drank. And it isn't boastful or pretentious to say you're recovered. You don't have to say anything, really. It's AA. But it's something to not deny a newcomer that we can get free of this thing, not cured. And we get free of it because of God's mercy and the relationship. We have more God, less me, more me, less God. So it's in the... Let me find it. Give me a second here. How many thousands... Title page. The story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcohol is the first promise in the big book. And it goes on to use the word recovered a handful of times. It doesn't say, you know, we're a bunch of drunks who are still recovering. And I'll just play with this for a minute. Let's pretend I break my pinky, God forbid. And Marion takes me to the hospital and they set it and they put a cast on it. And I don't know how long that would take. Let's say 6 weeks later, they take the cast off. And I go to physical therapy and it starts to work. In 3 years from now, I'm not going to be telling you I'm recovering from that broken pinky. I had a broken pinky. I hope it never breaks again. But imagine if I said 3 years later, yeah, I'm still recovering from that pinky I broke 30 years ago. I mean, you would say, wait a minute, isn't it healed yet? So with alcoholism, we're not cured. I'm not, I know that. But a day at a time, we get promised a road to getting recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So,
perfect. Thank you. The next question is, I'm struggling with the whole God thing. I feel I'm never going to get it. Any suggestions on what someone like me can do?
You have it. You have it. We just have to wake up to it. God didn't leave, you know, himself out of you. It's in our DNA. Whether, you know, Christians call it the Holy Spirit. Bill called it the great reality. Bill calls it God, the czar of the heavens, whatever you want or adjective you want to use to describe it. It's there. You know, we were born to be saints, whether we like it or not. We were called to sanctity, whether we like it or not. You, no one has to believe that. It's just the way it is. But for me, you know, we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I still had my issues with God. I can't see him. I can't feel him. I can't hear him. And you're telling me to turn everything over to this something out there. But I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because I can't stop drinking. And you were going to prevent me from drinking. And you are a group of drunks, G-O-D, for good early direction, G-O-D. And that's all I needed to start with. Our book says our own conception, no matter how inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach. All I need is I am willing to do what you tell me to do because it works in you. I already got a conception of a God. It's a group of drunks for good early direction. We're off to the races. That's all we need. And if we keep showing up to AA, there's a part of us that believes this place really works because there's a room of 100 people and everyone's sober and I can't stay sober. So I'm going to do what they do and say what they say. There's my higher power on that. Your God will reveal itself, herself, himself to you via the 12 steps. If not, the whole thing's a fake. Throw the big book out, get rid of the steps, get rid of AA. Everyone in our own way tells about our relation. Our book talks about this, our relationship with God and how we found this God. Yeah. You got it already. It's in there. And we'll wake up to go, oh my God, I got God.
Thank you. Do you have any suggestions for not taking yourself too seriously?
Yeah, I look at my bank account and I can't take myself too seriously. I got into like, I'm in AA now and we can't laugh anymore. And because I'm spiritual and everything is serious and, you know, I got to talk in that sponsor voice all the time. Oh my God, what work? I'm an alcoholic. That's a joke based on some of the things I did, not being an AA or being an alcoholic, but the things I did getting in here and the things my mind tells me sometimes. So rule 62, not to take ourselves too seriously. I take my AA serious. It is my life. This illness is deadly. God forbid it puts its hooks in us. But life, you know, I sometimes take myself a little too serious, but nowhere near how I came in. It's okay to laugh at yourself. Thomas Merton talks about that, the Trappist monk. I worked a lot of his stuff. He talks about, like, you know, it's okay if you trip over something and everyone sees you trip and you laugh at yourself. It's really okay. It's okay, like, if your hair doesn't look that good and you say, oh my God, look at my hair, and laugh about it. It's really okay. And it's not even that important. I need to wear the world like a loose garment. The thing I take most serious outside of AA is my New York Yankees. When they lose, I get really annoyed. That's very deadly serious to me. But I try to be, you know, light about things. I wish I was better with that.
Was your first trip through the steps with a sponsor out in Minnesota or after you came home?
when I was in Minnesota, some folks were showing me through the book, but I would say my first walk methodically through the book was with a gentleman, Tony N., out of Brooklyn, New York, who was just a great teacher for a guy like me when I first got there. And what he did was he took me from the cover of the book and we began going through the book. And I remember telling him, I see these pamphlets out there, different ways to do the fourth step. And I have to clean up the language, but he told me that the information was in this book. And he showed me, there's a blank page. See this blank page, you know? And he says, see this blank page? I says, yeah. He says, that's how much you know about recovery in life. Can we begin now? But back in Brooklyn when I came home from Minnesota is when my first real walk through the steps. And he held me accountable, which I love him for doing that back then.
So you did your first fifth step with him?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I love this one. I'm still not sure I'm an alcoholic. How can I be sure?
I you know, there's an old remedy that they would say, try to go out there and do some controlled drinking. That's what, you know, there's the old Monty Mann test, 2 drinks a day, no more, no less. But I forget how long it was, 30, 60, 90 days at the same time. I'm going to have 2 drinks, no more, no less at 12 o'clock. If you're a real alcoholic, that'll last 1 or 2 days. If you're not alcoholic, you'll look at it and go, I can't even look at this stuff anymore. I would hope you would stick around and try to identify with the stories. I wound up homeless. Your story may not be that graphic. It might be a penthouse apartment on Park Avenue with a Rolls Royce in the driveway. An alcoholic is an alcoholic. So don't compare, identify, and certainly listen to the end of our stories, because that's where God got our attention. It's that emotional bottom. I could be a homemaker with kids, send them off to college, and I can't get off a bottle of whiskey, you know, or I can be a gangster, or I can be a drug, whatever it is. If you can identify before you walk out the door. Having said that, some of us will go out and drink and find out we're alcoholic, and some will find out I'm just a hard drinker. I just hate sending someone out there to do some controlled drinking, but I'm not God.
What was your journey like that first trip through the amends with that first sponsor? You're going out to make your amends for the first time, and how'd that go?
Well, I'm still here, so it went relatively well, thank God. You know, there's so much to talk about with step 9. where we really start to take off, and I didn't know that going in, and I'm glad I didn't know that. But we talk about entering the world of the spirit in step 10 as we clean up the wreckage of our past, as we're cleaning it up. And it was a job I had to do because I couldn't be present knowing how I lived then. And as long as I have the, you know, driven by the past, how could I be free and move forward? I can't do it. And so it began, and, you know, my very first amends I remember making to a gentleman by phone in Minnesota, Bob B, his name was, he ran this halfway house, Bob Bannister. I don't know if he's even alive anymore. And for some of my nonsense when I was out there and my attitude around him and stuff, and he was an A member, he's, I know what you're doing. He's, it's great to hear this. And I walked into a meeting that afternoon, and it was a 9-step meeting, and the speaker didn't show. He said, you want to speak? I said, I just did my first amend, sure. A lot of them were challenging. Some were seamless. But I prayed before. The step 8 preps me, praying for the willingness. And the appointments that I had, I made sure I prayed to be the best copy of this book I can be, because it may be the only copy they read. And some people just showed up unexpectedly. And I remember going to people I work with who I had borrowed money and never paid back, and old employers who I did lousy things with. And I was a longshoreman for many years, and my contact was with truck drivers and other longshoremen that I borrowed money off and never paid back. And, you know, I would wait outside this diner where they would have breakfast, and I do like drive-by amends, and I wait for them to come out. And I was always nervous and a little insecure, but it was just God humbling me to do this right. I never went in arrogant. The first time around, I probably made about 200 direct amends. And if I have time, I can share a nine-step story with you. Is that okay? Our book talks about that the difficult ones turn out to be sometimes the most beneficial. So my dad had got me this apartment in Brooklyn, and I trashed it. I didn't pay rent, and I cursed the landlord out and borrowed money, never paid him back, almost burned the place out, and he threw me out. And it was ugly. And I hated this man. He was married, had a wife who was pregnant, and he had a little daughter. He was working full-time, going to school at night, and he had this nice house, and I rented out on the bottom. My dad got me this apartment. He had no idea he was renting to this thing that moved in. And when he threw me out, I despised him. And when I got sober, he was on my resentment list, and he was also on my 8-step list. And because of step 9, I could put him on my Christmas list nowadays. But when his name showed up on the 8-step, I remember telling my sponsor with a lot of graphic language, I ain't going to go see that, blah, blah, blah. And I still looked at what he did to me. So my sponsor says, we need to do something about this. So I wrote a lot more inventory, pray for willingness. And I had all the money I owed him, I would take out of my check and save it. So about 6 months or so goes by. This is a guy who doesn't want to go see this other person. And one Sunday morning, I get this inspiration to go see this guy. And I got dressed. I put on a nice dress shirt, a sport jacket, nice pair of pants, shaved, and looked like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I put that money in my breast pocket and off I went. Now, a couple of months before that, I was sitting in a restaurant and I was dating my ex-wife at the time. And I look across the restaurant, in the back was that landlord speaking to a buddy of his, eyeballing me. He recognized me. And it wasn't good looks. He was just eyeballing me as if to say, that's that bum who trashed my house and never returned after I threw him out. And there he is having dinner. And I couldn't sit and have dinner. I had to run away. I had to get out of there. So I get dressed and off I drive to his house, and I knock on the door, and his wife answered and let me in. They were surprised to see me. I asked, can I come in? And they said, sure. And I said, if I have a few minutes with you, I says, they said, you look great, which I was glad to hear that I didn't look like that bum anymore. And he says, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I've been sober this long. They weren't too familiar with AA, but they recognized sobriety. And I said that. And I'm here to clean up some things I did here. And they invited me to sit down, and I gave them the money I owed. And I talked to them about the harms I caused that I was clear on and how I'm living now. And I said to them, is there anything you need to tell me? And then I asked them, what can I do to make it right? And they were just so happy for me. And they had met my dad a couple of times at my worst moments, and they were happy for my dad. And we hugged and made some handshakes, and it was done. And here's where my whole life changed. As I was walking down the steps, getting onto the sidewalk to walk to my car, which was down the block. Now, I've tried to tell the story a million times from podiums, but I can't articulate what happened adequately, but I'll try. I couldn't feel my shoes touching the concrete, and I felt and even saw this whitish yellowish light surround me. And my eyes filled up with tears of euphoria. And I wasn't thinking, wow, I'm having an experience right now. Can't wait to get to home group and tell anyone. That thing has happened to me in meditation. We leave here for a moment. We're taken. And I was just in the rapture of this moment. I didn't say, well, I just left the men's. There was no time, but God shaped the time in which I found this. I don't remember going to my car, and I swear I'm not embellishing. I do not recall the drive home. All I can recall is this feeling that I never had before. And then I was putting my key in the door. I've never been the same. Out of an amends I never wanted to go make. We make amends here, and that changes. We change that and amends, and this happens, and we truly enter the world of the Spirit. Now, I don't rely on that to keep me sober this many years later, but something I walked away with, knowing that I'm known by my Creator. And God, what He did for me that day was gave me enough courage to go make this amends that I didn't want to go make amends, a sense of urgency to go do it. And when I got done, He unlocked the gates of hell for me. I have found most folks who don't complete amends are really untreated or get loaded if you're a real alcoholic. Now, that's not a law. Please, I don't want to sound that way. It's just my little experience in my part of my little universe.
Thank you. We are at the end of our time, but I'm at pains to just ask you one more question before we let you go and close up the meeting. And this comes from a brand newcomer. Suggestions on leaving rehab. I feel like I'm still there.
On leaving rehab? In other words, they want to AMA.
I just got out of rehab and I feel like I'm still there. You know, what should I do?
Oh, okay. So if I'm understanding this, just got out of rehab and you kind of still feel like you're in rehab even though you're out. Yeah, I've been to 7 treatment centers. It's really okay. You will adapt to Alcoholics Anonymous. What I'm going to suggest, being you asked me, I'm taking spiritual consent here, is please pray like your life depends upon it. The first day out of treatment is your most important day in your whole treatment center stay. So you're still going to have the treatment center modality in your head, and you're going to be wearing that a little bit. That's okay. It's like when you come back from vacation for a week and you get to work, you still kind of feel like you're in the Bahamas. I mean, it's really okay. But please pray, get in the center of AA, let people know you knew, and you'll start to get traction in this place. And congratulations for not walking out the door in treatment like I did. And your life is beginning right now. Please stick around. Beg God to keep you here. There will be some times where you're going to doubt yourself that you can't stay sober, and the residue of the illness will say, you know, a drink would be really nice about now. It's going to talk, but God's hollers a lot louder than that illness to keep you where it is. It'll scare the illness away. Please pray like your life depends upon it. Get a sponsor, and you don't need 90 days to go through the steps. God forbid a year. Start the steps like this week with the sponsor.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope that flew by for you, Peter. It flew by for me. I'm going to thank everyone who participated. Thank Peter so much, Larry, for wrangling the questions, everybody who read, and just for you showing up and spending your Sunday evening with us tonight. And Leanne, if you would read the last 3 paragraphs on page 164, please.
Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. My name's Leanne. I'm an alcoholic. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Leanne. And After the Lord's Prayer, you'll have the opportunity to unmute and thank Peter again. Let's have a moment of silence. Do with as you wish. And please, if you're new, stick around. Don't run out of here. Please, we're here to, we want to talk to you. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you, Peter. Just amazing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks, Peter. That was wonderful.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, sir, very much. Very good.
Thank you, Peter. You bet. Thanks for
thank
having
you. Me. Thank you.
Stay safe.
And thanks, David, too. And thank you, brother. Peter, so much.
We'll see you on the road, man.
Thank you, Peter.
All right, brother.
Peter.
See you on the road. Thanks,